All right, so I'm going to just get this started. Usually there's a, can everybody hear me? I assume you can and can't talk. All right, so usually there's, I'm here on my own today. So this is a Clubhouse on, is the pandemic finally over? Is there any end in sight? So I want to talk about where we're at after not quite two years of the pandemic. So the first thing to say about the pandemic is no, it's not over. If you look at the numbers, we are actually just coming off of some numbers that are in terms of cases and especially in terms of deaths that are as high as they've ever been since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, deaths in the thousands per day. Somebody estimated that about over the last, the previous 3 or 4 weeks, about 50,000 additional deaths from COVID. So, and all of that is because of the Omicron wave. Now, the Omicron wave is tailing off, which makes us think we're about to leave the end of this. But usually deaths follow the peak of the wave by a couple of weeks. So we're still, you know, fairly large numbers. They're starting to fall here in Virginia. They are falling elsewhere, but you know it means the pandemic is not over. If you look just by purely by the numbers of the number of people dying, the pandemic is not over. But there was a hope. And now when I scheduled this, Clubhouse a couple of weeks ago. And at the time, there was a sort of a hope that the trailing off, that the Omicron wave would be the final wave. And the idea is that the main differences between Omicron and previous waves of the current of COVID is that Omicron is far more infectious, meaning it's far more contagious. It's far more likely to spread to other people than previous ones. It's now, the numbers that they use here, this is the R0 number, which basically means the number of, for every person who gets infected, how many other people do they infect? And for measles, which is the high end, the most infectious, most contagious disease out there, it is about 18 people. For COVID, it's probably more like 7. It might be a little higher. And for the Omicron wave of COVID, it's about 7, maybe a little higher. For previous waves of Omicron, not before Omicron, the numbers were more like 3 or 4. So this is much more infectious. It's going to spread to a much larger number of people, much more geometrically. It's also proven, it's been so infectious that it's also proven to create a high number of breakthrough cases of people who were already been infected by previous waves or who have already been vaccinated, where you would think, okay, you're relatively protected. You know, it might not be perfectly protected, but you're relatively protected. Larger numbers of those people are getting reinfected because this is such a contagious strain of the virus. But the hope for Omicron was that that might actually end up being kind of a good thing, because the other thing about Omicron is it is considered less deadly or less less dangerous for each, you know, that your risk of getting the disease itself is inherently less severe, that it's more in the nose and less in the throat and less in the lungs, and that it has a lower death rate in terms of the number of people who get Omicron who end up getting, you know, hospitalized and end up dying. So the idea is, the hope for Omicron was that it would be, more people would get it, but it'd be less deadly. And so what you'd have is, you know, this would be the wave where finally everybody finally gets it, but hardly anybody gets sick. And, you know, we also have the fact that a large number of people around the world have been vaccinated already, especially in developed countries like the United States. Not as many as should be, but a large number. So the idea is that, you know, everybody would get it and everybody would get the natural immunity, and relatively few people would die. So this would be the final wave. Now, it looks that it's a little unclear still whether, so what I want to say is, to the extent that that's going to happen, I want to make point, the thing I want to say about it is, I thought by now, in late February, when I scheduled this, by late February, we'll have a really good idea of how that's working. Well, it's late February, and like I said, we're still in the tail end of that big Omicron wave. And what happened with Omicron is a lot more people, it turned out to be less deadly in terms of the number of people who get it, who become hospitalized or die, is much lower. But so many more people got it that we still have numbers. We ended up having numbers, this big Omicron spike. The number of deaths ended up being comparable to the previous big waves, the big winter wave of last year, especially where, you know, the deadliest portion of the pandemic was about this time last year, before the vaccines had really come widely available. And there was a long peak that happened going into February and March, and very large numbers of deaths. That was the highest number up to now. Well, we've pretty much equaled that with the Omicron wave. And the mathematics is, you know, is roughly along the lines of, it's half as deadly, but twice as many people get infected, it's half as deadly, but twice as many people get it. So you end up with roughly the same number of deaths. So we're not quite past that. We're going to know in the next couple of weeks. We're going to have the drop off. We're going to know exactly how far we drop off. But there's still kind of an open question. Will this be the last wave? Will so many people have gotten it this time and then so many people be vaccinated that we won't have another big wave that comes? And unfortunately, the bad news on that is it looks like that Omicron has a tendency to reinfection. That is, if we think, okay, if you have it, you have natural immunity and you won't get it again. Well, they're saying, no, it looks like it might be that you can get reinfected again, after 90 days or so. So people could get Omicron multiple times. And it's because of the fact that this is such an incredibly infectious variation on this virus. All right. So we still don't know that. And that's been a sort of a problem with the outlook on this, the public reaction to COVID from the very beginning, is that the basic problem as I see it, we can talk a little bit later about the CDC and the way it did the messaging and all the mistakes made by the government, of which there were many. But the biggest fundamental problem I see is that science is slow. And that is that, if you follow, scientific studies on other topics, what you find is that they will often take years to study a topic, years to go through it and figure out the, you propose a study, you get funding for it, you gather your test subjects, you observe them over a long period of time, you crunch the data, you publish it in a paper, you get responses, somebody else publishes a different study with different results, and then you have back and forth before it. It can take years to come to a solid conclusion about a scientific topic. And of course, we don't have years. It's been less than 2 years for the whole thing. So people want immediate answers now. And the science is inherently slow and can't really be, there are certain things you can do to speed it up, but it can't be sped up all that much. So the science is slow, but the public is impatient. And I think that's why you get then, filling that gap, you get the culture war we have over masks and over vaccines, where, people want to be able to take a firm stance on it one way or the other right now. They want simple answers delivered to them without having to, wait for the results. And people do a bad job of this is one of those cases where you have to make decisions in the face of uncertainty about the, long-term consequences and long-term results of what you're going to find out as the scientific studies get done over a period of years. You can't wait for that. You have to make decisions now. And people are generally very bad at that. They want something very simple. They want to, and they want an answer that, is absolute right now when that's not available. So as for the pandemic being over, is there an end to the pandemic in sight? I think it's not over right now. We're on the tail end of a big wave. We don't know how many other waves there might potentially be. So it's unknown to the extent to which the Omicron wave will be the last big wave, or whether there is, as has been happened before, there's going to be a trough going into the summer, and then another big wave in late summer or fall, and then again in the next winter. That's sort of what happened last year. You know, you had a big peak in the winter, you had a trough, you had another peak in late summer with the Delta wave, and then another peak in the winter with the Omicron wave. That could happen again. We don't know. But what I can tell you is the pandemic is going to be over in one sense, which is people have decided they want it to be over, right? So the public is done with taking precautions. That's the big thing that's emerged over the last month or so. The public is totally done with taking precautions. They don't want to do anything more. And so I think what we're going to move into, and I predicted this last fall, I think it got kind of delayed by the arrival of the Omicron wave. It got delayed by a couple months, but I think what we're moving into is what I call the live and let die stage of the pandemic. And that is the idea that people want the freedom to not be told what to do and not be told to wear masks or get vaccinated, you know, and they want that, we should be free to make our own decisions. And so the attitude is live, you know, it's the libertarian approach of live and let live, but we're going to do that. But it's going to be not the happy version of live and let live. It's going to be the unhappy version, which is live and let die, which is that there are going to be a lot of people, and this is already happening. They call it, the term being used for it is red COVID. That is that there's a gap that has opened up where in the quote unquote red states. Now, I always object to this terminology because I'm from the era when the reds meant the communists. And somehow in the 1990s, red came to mean conservative. But the so-called red states and the red conservative-leaning areas have more people who are resisting vaccination, more people who are resisting any kind of unreasonable measures, but any kind of preventive measures. They want to go back to living totally normal life as if COVID didn't exist. And the odd sort of somebody stated the paradox nicely, which is they said the people most at risk from COVID, which is the people who are unvaccinated, the people who have not taken precautions, the people who are unvaccinated and therefore at most risk from COVID are the ones who are taking the least precautions. And the people who are most likely to be vaccinated and most protected from COVID are taking the most precautions. So it's this weird sort of paradox that the people least at risk are taking the most precautions and the people most at risk are taking the least precautions. So I think what we're going to have is a sort of a live and let die pandemic, where or what they call red COVID, where the people we're going to say, you know, you cannot force people, you cannot. There's only so much you can do to save people from themselves. We're going to have to sort of return to normal, but in a way that there are people who have stubbornly resisted the best protection that they can get against COVID, and so we're still going to see much higher death rates than were necessary. And I think we're still going to have, you know, the pandemic's going to drag on for a long time, largely because of the people who have refused to take the vaccine and refused to protect themselves. Now, that's the flip side, the bad side of it. The good thing is, and I think we want to, in looking back at the pandemic so far, is I hate it when people call this, but somebody's talking about the miracle of the vaccine. Now, it's not a miracle at all. It's science, right? It's the opposite of a miracle. But what we've done with the COVID-19 is we developed a vaccine using mRNA technology and several other innovations. We developed a vaccine far faster than any previous vaccine and implemented it. And somebody, I just saw a figure that about half the world has now been vaccinated for COVID, which has never, ever, ever before happened in so short a time scale. And that's the amazing achievement of the pandemic. There's something I saw recently. Somebody said it's called McKeon's hypothesis, which is basically that in a situation like this, especially an infectious disease, that the medical interventions to treat it and to prevent it tend to not be implemented until after the whole thing has already run its course. And you can see that with the flu pandemic, the Spanish flu pandemic 100 years ago, that, you know, we have the normal flu vaccine we have had for decades now is a vaccine for that particular flu for previous versions of it. That vaccine was not developed until many years after the Spanish flu had already, you know, run its course and burned its way through and caused enormous numbers of deaths. And this is like the only time I can think of where we've sort of, one of the few times when we've short-circuited McKeon's hypothesis, where we've actually brought an effective measure into play to make this significantly less deadly while it was still happening. So that's the enormous achievement of, I won't call it a miracle, it's an achievement, a scientific and technological achievement, that we should, you know, we look back on the pandemic, we should be very grateful for. And that's the one sense in which the pandemic is over or is becoming over, which is that the data is pretty clear now, especially with the Omicron wave, that the risk of being hospitalized, the risk of dying is much, much, much smaller. If you have been vaccinated, and especially if you've been vaccinated and had the booster. So there's one sense in which the pandemic is over, which is if you want it to be over and you're willing to take that preventive measure, then for you, it is largely over. But it means also that, you know, there's that second track where if you refuse to take those precautions, then for those people, the pandemic is going to drag on in some way for a significant period of time. All right. So that's the main thing I wanted to do is the overview. And I think in the discussion, I'd like to, you know, maybe talk a little bit about what the government did, especially what it did wrong, and to the extent to which we had some of the lessons we can draw from that about anti-pandemic measures. Now, I am usually not in charge of bringing people up onto the stage, so I think you can raise your hand if you want to, and I can invite you onto the stage if you want to talk. I'm going to invite Scott up here if he wants to.
Hey there.
Hey there.
I'm sorry I didn't know. No one asked me to do this one, but...
Well, I don't know what happened, but that's fine. We'll wing it. This is, you know...
Okay.
I don't know if you have anything to say or if anybody else.
I mean, yeah, I have become jaded enough on this kind of scientific establishment that I have trouble believing that they're going to just ever say it's over until something happens as a catalyst from outside.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about that a couple times. One thing is, I think that, see, the way I've been following it, I don't want to talk about the scientific establishment, but there's lots of scientific sources that if you follow, it's one of these things where if you actually follow what is being done scientifically, it's not as confusing or as dishonest as it might seem from the outside. It's the confusing political messaging that comes around it. And I think what we've had is the pandemic has become a football in the culture wars, right? And so you have, and that's on both sides. You have the people who are, the sort of teachers unions types who are saying, no, the schools have to stay closed. We have to have complete masking in the schools, which is, I think, the most dubious anti-pandemic measure we've had. Because they're maintaining their side of the culture war because they have to be the opposite of, you know, the MAGA types who are saying, no, this is all made up. It's just the flu. It's all bogus. Who've been saying that from the very beginning. I also think there's a major problem that happened with the public messaging, especially from the CDC. And I think the thing is the CDC, in addition to everything else, I think, it's like a very subtle thing, but the CDC, I think, was designed, its public health messaging was designed around an era of mainstream media and the big three television networks. It was designed around this idea that you have this very centrally planned and controlled release of information. And you'd have people at the CDC deciding what's the exact best message to send out, you know, in their little conference room. And then they would send that out and it would be adhered to by everyone else, by the gatekeepers in the mainstream media. And they would have this very high level of central control over the information. And what I think happened instead is that this is the modern world, that access to information is so widely spread. And I think they became obsessed with the idea that, no, we have to have our people controlling the message, and we can't admit to any uncertainty in the data. And I also think that their public health messaging, remember, they haven't had a pandemic of this type for 100 years. So their messaging was also based around small and temporary events where you come up with a message, you send it out there, and it doesn't last very long. So, you know, this goes back to this issue I was saying earlier about slow science versus fast decision making, right? There's this big crisis, this big emergency, huge numbers of people dying, and you have to decide what to do. Politicians need to decide what to do about it, and individuals need to decide what to do about it, you know, on a scale of weeks or months, whereas the science takes years to go. So I think they're used to the idea that, well, we just come up with a message, we send it out there. And by the time all the science comes in and catches up and we start to decide, oh, well, we were wrong about that, the whole thing will be over and nobody will ever, you know, we'll study that at a scientific conference, but the public won't care. Well, when the thing lasts 2 years, what happens is you have science going back and forth on, well, do masks work or not? What kind of masks work? Do cloth masks really work? Do N95 masks work? Or, you know, the exact information about how transmissible it is, to what extent do mandates or lockdowns work? All of that take, you know, as more information comes out about that, you can't have that sense of we control the messaging and we will never admit to uncertainty. Because what's going to happen is the uncertainty is going to catch up with you, right? Where, you know, a much better approach would have been early on to say, well, we don't know. There's all sorts of things we don't know. We're going to give you our preliminary views, and we're going to have this very transparent discussion of the information. And you're never going to prevent the conspiracy theorists from latching on to things and, you know, abusing the data. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge, in order to keep up your credibility, you have to acknowledge that uncertainty. And I think they had this the CDC from the beginning, when their biggest first blunder in the pandemic was that they had to have centralized control over all testing for COVID, which meant that we basically never got testing off the ground, really, on a large scale, on the scale we needed in America. We never got it off the ground. Even now, we're still playing catch up. So, they all had to have everything so centrally controlled from the CDC headquarters that they were really unable to respond properly. And I think that's, you know, one of the big lessons to come out of this is going to be the failure of that central planning mentality. Now, let me see if there's anybody else who wants to hop on board. I don't know if there's a way to raise your hand or something like that.
If you want to make me a mod, I can bring people up as well.
Yeah, how do I do that?
It's one of the choices. But in the meantime, you know, there is just kind of this thing that happened, it seems, over the 10 years, you know, the last 10 years. I'm in Florida, and it just seemed like FEMA and all these people would get more shrill about every hurricane coming and just saying, you know, oh, if you're going to stay at your house, just, you know, put your ID on your toe so we can identify you at the morgue. And I just think that ended up becoming, I'm not saying that, you know, precautions didn't need to be taken, but it's the whole way that, you know, they couldn't have anyone questioning lockdowns, or even when they changed their mind on masks from, you know, they said it wasn't important when they were trying to make sure all the doctors had masks, and then, you know, switched on a dime once they were supplied and wanted everyone to have masks.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, though, I think that I've seen a lot of people use the bad messaging, the poor messaging of the government as kind of a crutch or an excuse, right? So the fact that the CDC has had bad messaging, or government agencies have had bad messaging, you should expect that. It's the government, right? You should expect they don't do things well, but it doesn't excuse you from the responsibility. As either as a private individual, or especially as someone, if you're someone in the media, it doesn't excuse you from the responsibility for being responsible for yourself and saying, okay, you have to go with good sources of information. So I see people basically saying, you know, the CDC, you know, they flock to sort of conspiracy theorists and people who are minimizing COVID. And they sort of have this, the CDC made me do it kind of attitude, you know, that you are responsible for coming up, as you always are, for coming up with good information. And that I want to lead to this question about mandates and lockdowns. So I think mandates and lockdowns tend not to work, but it's not because the thing that is being mandated doesn't work. It's because the act of mandating it is generally ineffective. So for example, when it came to lockdown, when it came to the early lockdowns, people say, oh, well, places that had lockdowns didn't really do much better than the places that didn't have lockdowns. But that's largely because of the behavior of individuals moved faster and moved with less control than the planners, you know, thought. You know, there's always in the public health. So in the public health field, there's this thing that, first of all, they are inclined to be, they have an incentive to always, you know, do that sort of like, you know, if you're going to stay in your house, put a toe tag on so we can identify your corpse. Because if people don't evacuate, it makes them, you know, and it turns out to be a huge disaster. They, you know, they get the blame. So they don't want to be blamed for anything. That's their, you know, the basic bureaucratic incentive. Oh, and by the way, Scott, I did make you a moderator. So if you want to pull anybody else up.
Yeah, some of that was post-Katrina when they used it to make Bush seem like a terror, mm-hmm. you know, because of his slow response.
Yeah, well, the thing that always bugged me about Katrina, though, is, you know, this is a failure. Well, first of all, it was a failure primarily on the state and local level in the hurricane response. And of course, but those were all Democrats, so you can't blame them. So you had to blame Bush. But also what really bothered me was that Katrina hit very devastating in Mississippi, not just in New Orleans, but across the river in the state of Mississippi. But nobody wanted to talk about that because, again, you couldn't make political hay out of it. And that's part of the overall problem with our politics, is that everything becomes part of the usual partisan battles. Everything becomes a football in the culture wars. But I do want to say that, you know, what I think is that the other sort of folly of the central planners is thinking that I can mandate a lockdown and that's going to make all the difference, when actually what they're generally doing is they're lagging they're lagging behind the behavior of private individuals. So when they declared the lockdowns, it was about 2 weeks after activity at restaurants and activity at large gatherings, et cetera, all of that had already gone through the floor as people stayed home of their own volition. That was one of the things. And then at the same time, you know, when they imposed the lockdowns, there were still people going out and going to gatherings. And, you know, so the people who were going to listen to you about locking down were already locked down. And the people who were not going to listen to you basically just didn't follow the order or found various ways to get around it. So there's a lot of overconfidence involved in when it comes to mandates and lockdowns. And we're seeing that with vaccines, that, you know, you can mandate the vaccine, but that doesn't mean that people are actually going to go out and get vaccinated. And then you'll end up with, you know, the increasingly stubborn and angry resistance like you're seeing in Canada. I think in Canada, they've had stricter government controls than we've had in the U.S. So you can see they're reacting against that. So, you know, I think it's this hubris of the central planner thinking I'll pass a mandate, I'll impose something from Washington, D.C., and that will solve the problem, when it actually really accomplishes relatively little. The people who were likely to agree with you that this was a good idea have already complied, and the people who don't agree with you aren't going to comply, and, you know, you're not really going to be able to put in the draconian enforcement methods necessary to make them do that. So there's been this tremendous overconfidence. And instead, you know, where you should have been focusing on messaging and education and convincing people, the act of persuasion. You know, I think there is some role for government in a pandemic. I think the proper approach is one that we never even tried, which is the test and trace approach, where you test people, you do mass testing and contact tracing. It's what they did in South Korea, with largely successful results, although they've had a hard time dealing with Omicron because it's so infectious. But up to that, they've had a fraction of the number of deaths, the fraction of the number of hospitalizations we've had, because they did the and with much less disruption to society. to their normal activity. But it's something we never even tried here. I think that would be a legitimate use of government power. But, you know, this is, but the idea of just sort of the central command approach, I think, has largely proven to be irrelevant or ineffective.
And we also want to invite others to come up on the stage. If you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll bring you up. I have to, you know, I hope this isn't too off topic, but I'm just curious. Leonard Peikoff came out last week and made a comment in full support of the truckers. I'm curious if you'd heard that and if you have any thoughts.
See, I wasn't in full support of the truckers. Now, I want to say that since that happened, the big changes happened is that, and this is so emblematic of our times, right? That the minute you start to criticize one side, the other side goes out and does something awful, and so you have to criticize them. So, in the current context, what's going on is that the Canadian government, let's start back on the truckers. I think there is a legitimate complaint against the truckers. I do not like the idea of basically a blockade, which is what they were doing, right? You have a legitimate right to protest. You don't have a right to blockade. You don't have a right to go into somebody else's neighborhood and essentially occupy it. I sort of thought of the trucker convoy in Canada as Occupy Wall Street, but for conservatives. And I also strongly disagreed with the cause that the truckers had, which is that from what I could tell, and again, coming from distance here, this is, you know, Canada is like a whole other country. It's kind of hard to figure out what's going on there. But from what I could tell, it was mainly driven by people who were anti-vaccine. So, you know, there's this, I think we have to sort of differentiate between, we could sit here and talk about how, well, vaccines are good, but government shouldn't be mandating them. And that's there's a really good argument. There's an argument to be made there. There's an argument. Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made in favor of vaccine mandates, but, you know, it's sort of the libertarian, I call it libertarian debate club. You know, we, the sort of principled laissez-faire people can sit around and debate theoretically what's the right approach. But in practice, what I could tell from what I could tell, the trucker convoy is it was mostly people who were against the vaccine. They didn't want to take the vaccine because they thought the vaccines were bad.
They didn't want to be forced to.
I looked for that. Are they making that? We think the vaccine is fine, but we don't want to be forced. An awful lot of them were basically against the vaccine. All right. So, and that's one thing I've been noticing. Like, for example, I just saw this and now I can't remember what state, somewhere in the Midwest, maybe it was Indiana. There was a state legislator who introduced a law that would ban private companies from mandating the vaccine, right? So this isn't, we're against the government vaccine mandating the vaccine. It's like a private company can't tell you you have to get vaccinated. So it was very, and what I've been seeing, especially online over the past months, is that opposition to the mandates spills over to opposition to the vaccine. And that's so much emblematic of our politics right now, because people don't have this concept of something's either mandatory or it's prohibited. They don't have a concept of, you know, if something shouldn't be mandated, then they don't have the concept of freedom that sort of fine differentiations. They have this idea that, you know, either something should be, it's like the debates, I'm had a good formulation for it, and I'm trying to recover that. I find it similar to the debates over wokeness and critical race theory in schools, right? So either you have the one side that wants to mandate that wokeness be imposed on everybody in schools, and then you have the other side that wants to pass laws banning anybody from mentioning anything even related to critical race theory. So you have, you know, it's not a question of people being free to make their own decisions. It's really a question of who's in charge, my side or your side. And that's so typical of things. And I think you can see that in the reaction to the trucker convoy in Canada, where instead of saying, look, we're just going to use the ordinary traffic rules, we're going to, you know, tow the cars that are blocking the bridges, we're going to tow the trucks and pound the trucks that are blocking downtown Ottawa,
they said, no, we're going to impose the state of emergency with special emergency powers, and we're going to, you know, track down the financing, and we're going to freeze people's bank accounts, and this incredible, you know, overreach that sort of goes against, you know, 500 years of British common law, and suddenly, you know, give the truckers what I think is an unmistakably legitimate grievance against the Canadian government. So again, it's one of these things, but I also noticed in that video where Leonard Peikoff came out in front of the truckers, what I found really interesting was that Amy Peikoff was trying so hard to get Leonard to sign up on being anti-vaccine because she's flipped to that side. And I was glad to see that at least he resisted that part.
Well, I think that I want to get to Bill, but I just want to say, I think that part of what they're responding to is this pressure on businesses from, you know, the establishment to have a vax mandate, like Biden basically explicitly did, even after the Supreme Court struck down the OSHA mandate.
Yeah, there's always pressure on businesses. I mean, I think the thing is, though, that actually passing a ban saying businesses cannot require people to become vaccinated, that really shows this attitude of, it's not about freedom, it's about who's in power, my side or your side. And like I said, I've seen a lot of the anti-vaccine approach gaining a foothold on the conservative side because they can't, again, it's this thing, you know, if we can't, they can't take that principled approach of we're for this but against coercing it. It, put it this way, when I hear libertarian arguments coming out of conservatives, I'm always suspicious because it's usually, in my experience, it's usually, and in this case, I think definitely, it's very opportunistic, right? They don't really, if they believed in this whole, these fine distinctions of, well, it's good, but we shouldn't, but the government shouldn't mandate it. If they believed in those fine distinctions, they would have totally different views on a whole range of other topics. So when I see conservatives grab what looks like a libertarian position, I'm always very suspicious of that it's a superficial and opportunistic thing. And I've been sort of seeing that we're not against the vax, we're against the mandate, keep slipping into we're against the vaccine. And I think that those, you know, these laws proposing, oh, well, we should ban private companies from mandating vaccines for their employees, that slips into the we're just against the vaccine kind of outlook.
Well, Bill, thank you for your patience.
Okay, I wanted to slip in a little factual observation here. According to my sources, most of the truckers were in fact vaccinated. Their protest was actually against the mandates, not against the vaccine itself. Although, of course, I'm sure in that 10% that were not vaccinated, you can find anti-vax people. So I do not think that categorizing them as anti-vaccine is accurate. That's one point. The other thing is that we do not live in an ideal society. We also do not live in a tyranny. And so I'm of the opinion that when the normal methods of dealing with government wrongdoing are not effective or are not available, then protest is the appropriate thing to do between doing nothing on the one hand, and on the other hand, taking up your guns and going after the government. So I'm with Peikoff, although I disagree with most of what I read, listened to it in his thing, because it was basically a conservative talking speech, and I didn't approve of that. But I agree with his conclusion. The truckers were within their rights to protest, even if it inconvenienced a lot of people. So I think that's my say on it.
Okay, so I want to talk briefly about the cause, the motivation of the truckers. So it's hard to gauge from a distance. Like I said, Canada's like a whole other country. It's strange up there. And I've been working hard to try to find that. One of the things that tipped me over the edge is I saw a widely shared article that started out with, I think it was at Barry Weiss's Common Sense Substack, widely shared article proposing to say, here's what the truckers want. And it starts out by saying, it's not really about the vaccine. And then every single person she interviewed was somebody who had refused to take the vaccine and was, you know, thought the vaccine was dangerous or something like that. So it was like, I've rarely seen an article where the initial thing that tells you what the article is going to be about is so completely contradicted by the actual subject of the article. But, you know, so that's, that's something I'm trying to gauge from a distance and trying to figure out. And you get a lot of very partisan sources telling you, somebody assuring you, oh, 90% of them are vaccinated. And you're like, well, how do you know? How can you tell? So I think 90% of Canadian truckers are vaccinated, but that's not necessarily the subset that's there at that protest. But I think the much more interesting topic is the one second one you brought up, which is the ethics of protest. And it's something I think it's just, maybe we'll do a whole other clubhouse on this at some point. I'm trying to go out and I'm going to do some stuff on it at Symposium. I want to do it at more of a 30,000 feet level where it's like, let's not just talk about the details of this one protest. Let's talk about, you know, the Boston Tea Party. Let's talk about the Whiskey Rebellion. Let's talk about the uprising in 2014 in Ukraine that kicked out the Putin-backed government. Let's talk about all these different, you know, let's talk about Occupy Wall Street, and let's talk about the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle. Let's sort of look at all these different examples and talk about what are the principles in terms of when should you protest, how can you protest, what's appropriate for different kind of conditions. And I think it's something objectivists have never really talked about because we're not the protesting type, right? and I think that's probably all the better for us because we've been the let's write articles, let's write books, let's advocate for ideas types, which I think is way more effective. The thing I most disagreed about, and which I found almost kind of sad in that Peikoff video, was he said, things are so terrible. He's always been a things are so terrible guy. He's been very, he always has a pessimistic outlook. Things are so terrible. We're so close to tyranny. Writing a book isn't going to change anything now. We need to do action. And I thought, well, is this Leonard Peikoff talking? Because this is a guy who spent his whole life basically advocating that no, you know, advocating ideas is the only thing that's going to change something. So it was almost sort of like sad to see that sort of surrender to that outlook. I totally disagree. I think writing books and articles and having clubhouses and talking about things, I've been to protests. I've went to Tea Party protests and things like that. And writing articles and talking and advocating is way more effective than anything we did with the massive, we had massive protests. Talking to people and writing articles is way more effective than any of that. But I think there's an interesting, whole interesting discussion. I know we're getting sort of down to the end here, so we can pursue this if you like, because I think there's a certain level of protest of just like going out in the street and holding signs and saying, here's where we stand is always, you know, there's no reason that should ever be banned or there's anything wrong with it. But then you get to, you know, civil disobedience, breaking the law, blockading bridges, blocking traffic. And then, you know, there's these various steps all the way up to, you know, insurrection, like on the far end of things, where you actually are going out in the Whiskey Rebellion, you're going out and you're hanging the tax collectors or whatever. And, you know, you have to have extreme provocation. The greater, the more forceful your method of protest, the more extreme the kind of provocation that would be required to make that justified. And I think generally forcible protest, where you're blocking people, where you're blockading a city, all that sort of thing is only justified to the extent that you are being blocked from using ideas and words, that you're being blocked from using speech to affect what the government does. So that's but we could do a whole
yeah, that off. Could be its own show, and maybe we should talk about doing that. But I do want to get Roger in before getting TAS founder David Kelly in. Roger, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, no, this is exactly the reason I raised my hand is to ask the question, you know, well, what is an effective form of protest? And it sounds like we probably need a separate room to get into this conversation in a thorough way. I'll say this from a distance. I look at what happened in Canada with the truckers, and I thought to myself, hey, look, here's a large amount of people that are now actually saying, you know, enough is enough. And the observation that I had that I thought was interesting is that The people that we typically hear that we need a revolution from are people that are on the left, and that what they say is that the workers are going to rise up. Well, here the workers rised up, and then the left threw them under the bus. And so, like, I'm now confused. Like, the right doesn't like the way that the left protests. The left doesn't like the way that the right protests. And I'm kind of confused on what the heck are we supposed to do if we decide that protesting is what we ought to do. And let's remember that, some things are worth protesting, other things are not. And in the grandest sense of a protest, I could think the American Revolution, if that was a revolution that started with a protest. And when the government didn't, recognize, the rights that the people demanded, then it was worthy of a fight. And I don't necessarily think that not trusting vaccines is certainly not a reason to fight. But when these encroachments that we're seeing over time on individual rights, again, I think this is probably would be better set up for another room where, what is the proper provocation to have a protest, and where do you take these protests if the government is not recognizing your rights? Like at what point do you know that it's okay to use your trucks to blockade train routes, and at what point is it maybe even justified to take that protest even further, and why is it that we're all so hypocritical about that protest is bad because I don't believe what they're protesting for is a good idea or worthy of protest. And I would love to see personally people just be more ideologically, consistent, when we observe these protests. I certainly think that property damage and hurting innocent people there's really no place for that. But short of that, I think that a well-oiled machine of good intention, and I love the distinction that you make, Rob, between the people that are anti-mandate and the people that are anti-vax, and there is this bleeding in. I hear a lot of people say, "Oh, I'm pro-vaccine, I'm pro-science, I'm pro-medicine, I'm just anti-mandate," but then every word that comes out of their mouth after that is is all of these reasons of why people should be worried about the vaccine, rather than talking about the mandate. So, anyways, I don't even know if I'm asking a concise question. Maybe just reemphasizing the need for an additional room to talk specifically about protest would be my request.
Okay, so tell you what, I think next week I'm talking about. I have a topic already set up for next week. I have a whole list of topics for the weeks after that I don't think they've been fully set yet. So I'm gonna get in contact with the people at Atlas Society, and 2 weeks from now, I think we talk about protests. I think it's a whole topic. But, Roger, the really simple rule here, though, it's actually quite simple at the end. People I like are entitled to protest. People I don't like are not entitled to protest. Very simple rule. Very easy to remember. that's the working definition most people have. And I remember about this time last year, during some of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, that there were a lot of conservatives insisting you had a right to run protesters down with your car if they blocked you in the street. And then these are the same people saying, no, that's the trucker thing is totally different. So again, it's like people I like are people I like can protest, and people I don't like aren't entitled to protest. And that's the working definition most people have. So I think we definitely do another whole room on it. But anything more about the pandemic and whether it's winding down, and basically what I'm proposing here is we have a reluctant truce of sorts, or a tragic truce of sorts, where the Canadian trucker thing is an indication that the point at which you can mandate this on people, the point at which you can sort of, the vaccines work, but the point at which you can save people from themselves has sort of, you get to very rapidly diminishing returns on that. And to some extent, we're going to have to accept the live and let die solution, which is, we're not going to force you to do this, but you're going to be the one primarily to pay the price for it, just by the nature. And so the pandemic's not going to be over for you. It's going to continue to dribble on. And fortunately, we, those of us who are vaccinated, are mostly protected to a fairly high level.
Every time you say live and let die, I get that Paul McCartney song in my head.
I know, that's either a plus or a minus, depending. You can blame me or thank me for that. It's one of the better ones, I think, musically.
Yes. Dr. Kelly, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, sure. I want to thank Rob for a very intelligent and well-informed presentation. And I think this issue of protest is a great one for its own topic. I just want to throw one thing into the mix. Bill mentioned the fact that we're in a mixed economy where principles are mixed and people have trouble isolating good principles from bad ones. But on top of that, many people don't function really in terms of principles. And they're very concrete bound. And the physical protests, like that of the Canadian truckers, make a point. They make headlines. Rob, you're a prominent author. You get a lot of attention. I've done some things that have gotten some attention, but nowhere, I've never been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or anything like that. The truckers have been. And so I think there's some role here. And this is very culturally sensitive. I'd much rather live in a world where people function in terms of ideas, but that's not our world right now. And so more power to you in setting up a follow-up session, I think would be very interesting. So anyway, thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, so the thing is that I'm kind of digging into the material for next week, but just part of the problem with the question of protest is that the whole theory of protest has largely been developed by the far left, right? So there's a whole theory of protest that's based around the idea that the people will rise and we will have the revolution that will overthrow capitalism. And every time I look, in the last few days, I was looking for what's out there. What are people saying about the ethics of protest? And almost all of it comes from the ethics of protest is about how we have the people rise up against the capitalist system. And it's all just from a totally leftist viewpoint that, they assume that when the people rise up, they're going to rise up on our side. And of course, they don't. And that was, I think, Roger's point about how, they keep saying the proletariat's going to rise and the workers rise up, but it's for something they didn't expect.
I agree. And I'll just throw in here that, Atlas Shrugged is, in its own way, the ultimate protest novel and movement. I hope, if we do this again, a full session on protesting, the withdrawal of the sanction of the victim is of a piece with, I think, but more sophisticated than similar protests by Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and others. So,
So in my book on Atlas Shrugged, I have a whole chapter comparing Atlas Shrugged to Vaclav Havel's manifesto, "The Power of the Powerless," because it's also, and I was amazed. I hadn't looked at it. I was amazed at the parallels because it's also about this idea of basically withdrawing your sanction. Withdrawing your, he has the famous example of the grocer who puts a sign in his window that says "Workers of the World Unite," and he doesn't care about the workers of the world uniting. He does it because he's afraid. He's afraid that he'll be in trouble if he doesn't put this sort of symbolic show of support for the regime. And his whole thing is withdraw that sanction. Stop putting the sign in your window, and go basically form alternative institutions and ideas and. Art that's not supported by the regime and start doing things. He doesn't say go to a valley, but he says, basically create your own parallel life, a parallel life where you're living inside, living within the truth is the term he uses. So it's a really interesting parallel. So there is a sort of objectivist theory of protest that I think could be developed. But like I said, we're not the protesting types. We haven't done it.
Yeah, Rob, thanks. I haven't gotten to that chapter in your book, which I've been reading with great pleasure. I would just, you know, recommend everyone get Rob's book. Who is Ayn Rand? So who is John Galt anyway? Is that correct?
Yes, that's it. Great book. Yeah, available at Amazon and the finer internet spots near you. So anybody have anything they want to bring out about the pandemic to finish out? Because I think where we're at right now is, see, what I don't like about it, though, is there is a certain subjectivism to the attitude I'm seeing on a lot of people, especially on the conservative side. And the subjectivism is, I think it was Barry Weiss who went on Bill Maher's show and said, I'm done with the pandemic. I was like, well, you don't get to decide whether you're done with the pandemic, right? Yeah, it reminds me of the whole, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. You don't get to decide whether you're done with the pandemic. The pandemic decides whether it's done with you. So, that has to be determined not by your personal fatigue or by your being fed up with restrictions. It has to be decided, and this goes to the issue I was saying of the personal responsibility. It's like, the government mandates that you wear a seatbelt. Does that mean you should rebel against wearing seatbelts? Well, no, you as an individual make your own decisions and decide, yes, wearing a seatbelt is a good idea. So again, you have to the extent, put it this way, to the extent that you don't want government mandating things to you and telling you what to do, that almost increases your personal responsibility to say, I have to go out and decide what the evidence indicates, what the best thing is to do, and what measures I should be taking to protect myself and the people around me. And in my case, I take more protective measures probably than most people do, because although I don't consider myself to be at particularly great risk, I'm at the area of if I were unvaccinated, I'd have above average risk at my age range. But it's because I've got, I spend a lot of time with my parents. They live nearby. They're almost 80 years old. I'm focused on, they're going to be more, even though they're vaccinated, they're still going to be more vulnerable. And of course, I have the luxury, I don't have kids in public schools. By the way, I have to acknowledge that. I'm a lot less angry about pandemic restrictions. And I always have to remind myself that the reason I'm a lot less angry is I don't have kids in public schools. So my kids were not abandoned by their teachers, as they were in especially in some of the big cities like New York and Chicago. My kids were not abandoned by the public school system for over a year. So that makes me significantly less angry about the whole issue. I have the ability as a writer to also have less contact in the world and withdraw more. And it comes to me naturally to not want to spend too much time with people. It's a lot easier for me to do it, and I perhaps have less fatigue. But again, the responsibility is on you to decide and to get the best objective information you can and to make your decision. Regardless of what the government is telling you to do one way or the other.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for taking on the topic in the first place. I think it's a great sign when one topic kind of leads to another. It's building like the hierarchical nature of knowledge. So we'll see what comes of the next show. Maybe we'll see if we can set something up on here in Healthy Debates. But thank you to everyone who joined us and who participated. And thank you. We'll see you again next time.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Scott.